You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with the editor of Think Africa Press, James Schneider. James, what do you have for us today?
Nigerian militant group Boko Haram have been labelled a foreign terrorist organisation by the United States. We'll also be looking at international climate change negotiations which have kicked off in Warsaw, and the leaking of an international trade and corporate rights agreement which has been released by WikiLeaks.
Look forward to that. Thank you very much indeed, James. Also, two far-right populist leaders, Marine Le Pen and Geert Wilders, have met to discuss a European coalition. We ask, what would work and who will be invited to come along?
Also, on this preview of this week's edition of The Urbanist, we find out why our mayors should be the most important political figures in our lives.
We do see a greater portion of millennials choosing to live in denser areas, places that are walkable, livable, bikeable, more connected, frankly, where people have more choice.
All that, plus we play some great music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Thursday edition of the program, but before we get started, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The US Secretary of State John Kerry says he's opposed to new sanctions against Iran, warning that they could scupper international talks on the country's nuclear program. A US Senate committee is considering imposing new financial restrictions on Tehran. Another round of talks between Iranian officials and representatives from world powers is due to take place later this month. Mr. Kerry says nothing should be allowed to threaten them.
The fact is that we didn't put sanctions in place for the sake of sanctions. We did it to be able to negotiate and to negotiate a final agreement. Now, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed here. We have an ability to be able to dial the sanctions back up if they don't abide by the agreement.
Relief workers in the Philippines say they're worried that disease could quickly spread among survivors of the country's powerful typhoon. While aid is now reaching some of the worst affected areas, access to clean water is still a priority for many of the 11 million people affected by the storm. The country's government says it's facing its biggest ever logistical crisis. 37 years after the former Brazilian president João Goulart was laid to rest, authorities have exhumed his remains. A new autopsy is to be carried out amid allegations that he may have been poisoned. Goulart was elected president in 1961 and then ousted by a military coup in 1964. He fled to Uruguay and then Argentina, where he died in his sleep of an apparent heart attack in 1976. But rumours persisted that he had in fact been murdered. Both his family and Brazil's Truth Commission have strongly supported the process to exhume and examine his remains. Enrollment for President Obama's troubled healthcare system is lower than expected. The administration says only 27,000 people have enrolled for health insurance via the federal website during its first month of operation. In all, around 106,000 people were insured, most of them via state-run websites. It had been estimated that nearly 500,000 people would join the scheme in the first month, but the website's been hit by a series of problems. The administration has promised it'll be running smoothly for most users by the end of the month. Toronto's embattled mayor has rejected fresh calls to stand down. Rob Ford was at a city council meeting to hear colleagues say he should step aside while he gets help for his drinking and drug use. The mayor has admitted smoking crack cocaine and regularly being drunk, but he again insisted that he doesn't have a long-term substance abuse problem. 30 of the city's 44 councillors signed a non-binding petition calling on him to go, and it was passed by a vote of 41-2. Councillor Jay Robinson read from the petition, which said that the council has become increasingly concerned by recent events.
Toronto is distracted, and for good reason. Our city's reputation has been damaged and continues to suffer, and it has become difficult to focus on the pressing and substantive issues facing City Council. Together we stand to ask you to step aside and take a leave of absence, to address your challenges privately, outside of the public eye.
The Pink Star, a huge flawless pink diamond, has sold for 76.3 million Swiss francs, including commission fees, in Geneva. Sotheby's say it's a world record price for a gemstone at auction. The oval-shaped diamond mounted on a ring weighed in at 59.60 carats. It was bought by a man bidding in the room who said he was buying it on behalf of an anonymous person whom he represented. He wouldn't give his own name. Here's auctioneer David Bennett.
All the gemstones know, coloured, the rare pinks and blues and greens and so forth are amongst the rarest of all stars. And they're finally, I think, reaching the levels where the price is matching the rarity.
Diamond Geezer. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
$83 million US dollars for that gemstone, Barney. Quite a price.
I wonder if it's the same person that bought that Francis Bacon for 140 odd million yesterday. Some people simply have too much money.
I'm a bit disappointed, though, Barney, you didn't do any singing. I caught some of it on one of our earlier programs.
That's what I want.
Barney, this is becoming a regular feature of our shows. Thank you so much for that little aria there. It is 6 minutes past five in the evening in Tokyo, 10:06 in the morning in Helsinki. It is 8:06 Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London, and it's time now to set the day's news agenda. And we're joined here in the studio by James Schneider, who is the editor of Think Africa Press. A very warm welcome to the show to you, James. The first thing you've picked out to discuss is that the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram, and we've been talking about this a little bit in the news as well, has been designated as a foreign terrorist group by the United States. Tell us why this is so significant.
Well, this means that nobody can provide any support for Boko Haram or their other splinter group, Ansaru, and that there are meant to be asset freezes on any of its sort of senior leaders. It's not really important, though, for that reason, because not enough is known about the senior leaders, and it's not like they're kind of well-understood and well-developed funding mechanisms like there are with other groups. It's more significant because it presents the US's really strong support for the Nigerian government, which is currently engaging in reasonably controversial, really aggressive military assault on three northeastern states where Boko Haram is mainly located.
I think, though, for a listener hearing this news for the very first time, might be surprised to think that Boko Haram is only now being considered a terrorist organization after killing so many people over the last few years.
Yes, so it's come as a surprise to quite a few people that it isn't already. It doesn't mean that America wasn't previously treating it as a terrorist group, but it's a particular legal classification, which means that it's a crime for anybody to support or engage in any transaction with Boko Haram or this other group, Ansaru. So it prevents anybody engaging in any business activity, providing any banking facilities or anything like that. So it's not as if they've gone suddenly woken up one day and gone, oh my God, they've killed 2,000 people. They must be terrorists now. But anybody who supports them now pretty much falls under counterterrorism legislation as well.
James, just remind us briefly, what exactly is the agenda of Boko Haram? What are they fighting for?
It's not 100% clear because what we know about them is at times a bit contradictory, but basically they support the establishment of an Islamic State in at least northern, but probably all of Nigeria. They oppose the Nigerian government and its security forces for extrajudicially killing its leader in 2009, and it opposes the establishment of schools and Western-style education in the north of Nigeria.
James, let's move on to another subject which you've highlighted for us. The climate change conference in Poland has kicked off once again. Should we be optimistic that there could potentially be some sort of agreement?
Well, there'll be some sort of agreement. It will probably I mean, it won't be in any way sufficient to stop the temperature rising by more than 2 degrees. But the timing is in some ways precipitous. So one of the things which in last year's agreement, they managed to say they will get on the agenda to actually discuss more concretely this year, is something called loss and damage. So that is what loss and damage have countries already experienced because of climate change, and what are they going to experience, and how is that going to be compensated? And, you know, generally the countries that suffer most from climate change are poorer countries, and they're not the countries that that did it. So, for example, the least developed countries bloc, which represents about 1 billion people, some of the poorest in the world, they've caused 1% of historical greenhouse gases, but are 5 times more likely to suffer adverse effects of climate change. And this has really come to the fore because of the typhoon in the Philippines, and because of the link between climate change and the frequency of extreme weather conditions, or the exacerbation of extreme weather conditions. No one's saying that the typhoon is caused entirely by climate change, but that it may have been made worse by climate change, which means that more people will have died and more homes will have been destroyed. And this is helping push up this loss and damage thing up the agenda.
There's a huge split in opinion on this subject all over the world. But at those talks in Warsaw, is there a clear division, excuse me, between the richer countries and the poorer countries at those talks? Have there been any examples of it sort of coming to blows? Is there just, you know, there's still the people who say, for example, that climate change is all a fairy tale? Are those people there, or is it not quite as split as it was?
I don't believe that it's any. I mean, apart from perhaps Australia, it's. I don't think it's any government in the world's negotiating position that climate change is a fairy tale and that it isn't something that should be dealt with. But there is a really massive split between the poorer countries, the countries which in general have not caused climate change and in general are worst affected by it, and those countries which are more developed, richer, and have caused the majority of and have far more fossil fuel dependent economies. So there is a real disjunct. And this brings me on to the second thing that's the most important element of these negotiations, which is about funding. So previously they've agreed that from 2020, rich countries will pay $100 billion a year to mitigate against the adverse effects of climate change for poorer countries. But they haven't worked out where this money is going to come from, who's going to pay it, and whether it's just going to be repackaging aid money. And this conference will be really vital in finding out a lot more about who's going to pay that money and how is it going to be paid.
But to the argument where you have not necessarily climate change skeptics, or perhaps those that think this is all cyclical, you know, there's some new data out from the Netherlands Environmental Assessment Agency, which says that CO2 growth rates have dropped something like 1.4% this year. So the most it's dropped in kind of more than a decade. Do you see that kind of camp within these negotiations having a stronger voice, using this kind of data, saying, you know, perhaps we should just take a more wait and see approach?
I'm sure that some will, but as I said, there is no. I mean, so America, for example, which is really, you know, really quite against in its negotiating positions coming to any kind of large reduction agreement if China isn't involved, which basically means it isn't that interested. But even they'd say that climate change is a real, you know, the American government is a real and significant issue and it needs to be dealt with, but they're just at odds with the other countries on how that should be done.
Let's move on to our final topic of the day, James. WikiLeaks has published yet more secret, little known information, yeah. Let's say.
So this is the most important story of today that you probably don't know about yet. There's this international agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is an international trade and corporate rights agreement, which is currently being negotiated between the USA and 11 other Pacific Rim countries, Japan, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand. It's been done in private, very, very, very secret. And it's could have, when it's passed, it could have quite profound effects on what kind of laws countries can pass and what kind of rights companies can have, and also questions of intellectual property, what kind of medicines will be available to poorer countries. And so any extra information that comes out about it is very important, and it's fortunately got the bipartisan Congress up in arms about the way it's been negotiated.
Well, what's it? What's in it that's causing such controversy?
There's a huge package of things which are causing controversy, mainly because they impinge heavily on countries' sovereignty. So in it, it says that companies will be able to privately sue governments for losses to profits for any adverse regulation that the government brings forward. So if you want to bring an environmental regulation and this reduces the profits of a polluting company, the polluting company would then be able to sue the state for its loss of money. So it really would massively tie the hands of governments in regulating business practices. But in the bit that's just come out now, which is on intellectual property, the real controversial element is taking medical patents beyond 20 years, which would raise the costs of drugs and especially make generic drugs more difficult, which would make healthcare far more expensive in the developing world.
James, fascinating stories as always. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, many thanks for joining us on the program.
Well, still to come, two European far-right leaders would like to combine their forces ahead of next year's EU elections. We ask what to expect right after this.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana, the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details, and if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9 to 5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to the programme, 8:18 Greenwich Mean Time. Now, liberating Europe from the monster of Brussels. That's the goal of the leader of the Dutch Freedom Party, Geert Wilders, who's just announced that he's joining forces with what he described as the like-minded Marine Le Pen, who is the leader of France's far-right Front National. Well, by joining forces, these two anti-immigration Eurosceptic parties are hoping to be able to win big in next year's European parliamentary elections.
But these two parties are by no means unique to the Netherlands and France. Greece, Hungary, Italy, and the United Kingdom all have parties pushing similar agendas. So just what is their agendas? Well, and how likely are they to succeed in next year's elections? Well, joining us on the line is Monocle's correspondent in Brussels, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson. Welcome to the program, Charlotte. How big of a move is this from Wilders and Le Pen by joining forces ahead of these European elections?
Well, it's quite significant because there's been concern in Brussels for some time that these parties at the extreme of both the left and the right and parties which basically don't support the idea of the European Union are really growing in strength. But what EU officials had been quietly hoping was that they would not be able to bridge these quite significant policy divides between all the parties. Because if you look at some of the right-wing groups, you have some of the very, very far-right groups, which openly espouse quite racist language. And then you have groups like Marine Le Pen's National Front, who really will try and distance themselves from these sort of parties outside the mainstream. But this announcement by Wilders and Le Pen, I think, will cause some consultation in Brussels, because if they are able to bring together a lot of these sort of right-wing, Eurosceptic groups, that could prove quite a challenge if they do manage to form a bloc in the European Parliament elections after May next year.
It's ironic, isn't it, Charlotte, that an anti-European agenda could be really set to dominate affairs there in Brussels, supposing they do manage to win big.
Yeah, absolutely. Marine Le Pen herself said that she wants to bring down the EU from the inside. So that's their goal, and certainly that's been the goal of UKIP, who already have a fair number of MEPs. Nigel Farage is quite keen on getting up in the European Parliament and spending quite some time bringing down the very parliament that he's in, or attempting to anyway. So, yes, absolutely, there does seem to be some sort of contradiction there, but they don't see it. They see getting into Brussels as a way of getting out of Brussels, or at least of making some sort of significant changes to the way the EU works.
And, of course, a lot of the momentum behind these parties, of course, is the tough austerity, the tough economic times facing much of Europe. But there's a long time, roughly 6 to 7 months between now and when the elections will take place in May. A lot could potentially happen in that time period. If this economic recovery speeds up, if we see positive growth numbers, rising employment, could that potentially spell the downfall for these right-wing parties in Europe?
Possibly, because as you said, it really is these desperately sort of hard economic times which have boosted support for these parties. But if you look at it, it's been going on now since 2008, and their support has been slowly rising since then. So it's going to have to take quite a bit to turn it around entirely before May. And there has been some good news. The Eurozone exited recession at the end of the second quarter. We're due to get the third quarter results today. They could be quite positive. But despite this, the unemployment figures are not really shifting yet, and that is what's causing this real disillusionment, this real sense of hopelessness in the future, this real sense that the EU has not done enough to help the ordinary people, and there isn't that much sign of those employment figures shifting dramatically in the next few months.
And Charlotte, do you think all these different far-right groups can actually work together? I mean, they're all quite different in terms of the message they're trying to give off about just who they are. Marine Le Pen very much trying to sort of water down, for example, her father's style of speaking and the messages that he, the rather fiery rhetoric he used to produce. She's much more moderate. But then, you know, you've got parties like the Golden Dawn in Greece, which are perhaps facing their own downfall for different reasons at this particular moment. But do you think they can all work? Do they sort of see eye to eye, these various different far-right groups?
Well, that's a good point. And first of all, I should say on the extreme right parties such as Golden Dawn, they're not actually allowed to participate in the European Parliament elections because they're seen as being racist. So there are certain measures that the European Parliament has taken that they can't be represented there. So the real extremists won't be there. But yes, the ones on the slightly more moderate far right, they also do have quite significant policy differences. For example, Le Pen and Wilders differ quite wildly on Israel. Wilders supports Israel. Marine Le Pen, on the other hand, has not, though she's spoken out on the other side. So there are various issues that they don't seem to unite on. And already UKIP have said quite clearly that they don't want to join this alliance. They say, we're not far right, we're libertarians. So again, you have that issue with language. And in different countries, the language is really important. You say far right in the UK and certainly in Scandinavia as well. And there's a real sort of, a shudder. People don't like to have that sort of language associated with their party, whereas in other countries it's not the same. So there are differences. But the issue is, if they all fight their own platforms, will they come together after the parliament elections? Because once they've won their seats, then they need to start looking at how to have political clout within the parliament. And to form under one banner gives them more speaking time, more funds, more staff. It gives them a lot more clout. So what Wilders is certainly hoping that UKIP and other parties that are slightly cautious at the moment might then join forces with them once they've got MEPs in the parliament in May.
All right, thank you so much for that, Charlotte McDonald-Gibson there in Brussels. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's 19:24 in Sydney, 10:24 in Istanbul, and 8:24 here in London. We're headed to Turkey next, though, to check in with our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, Joseph Dana. Joseph, welcome to the program as always. Shall we begin, though, with the story that you reported on last week for us here on Monocle 24, and that was about the Kurds in northern Syria declaring an autonomous region.
Absolutely. It's been one of those weeks in the Middle East in which kind of regional geopolitical alliances have been redefined and reshaped. And so effectively, the Kurds in northern Syria have been fighting with jihadist al-Qaeda-linked rebels for quite some time now, and they've been able to take over a number of key towns, villages, and border crossings, one specifically with Iraq. And they've gone and done the kind of big measure of declaring an interim administration in this part of Syria, effectively sowing the ground for their own state in northern Syria that is completely separate from the centralized Syrian state, or what's left of the centralized Syrian state. Now, the reason why I said that this is redefining geopolitical alliances is that it comes at a time in which Turkey is in advanced negotiations with Iraqi Kurdistan for some energy agreements in terms of bringing the energy resources out of the ground in northern Iraq and then shipping them into Europe via Turkish land and sea crossings. And so we have the Turks in a very interesting position where they're negotiating openly with Iraqi Kurdistan at a time in which they might be faced with the prospect of a new Kurdish state or autonomous region in northern Syria.
And earlier this week as well, we heard from several jihadist groups that are fighting the war in Syria to take up arms and reclaim this territory that was taken by Assad troops, as well as Kurds in the north of the country as well. What kind of impact will that have on the state of play?
Well, I think it's definitely, it demonstrates that this is an entrenched civil war that's not going anywhere anytime soon. Because the Kurdish rebels in northern Syria were able to take over these key supply crossings, these border crossings into Iraq, it shows that the Kurdish rebels there, if you want to call them rebels, have thought ahead in terms of this military confrontation with the jihadist forces. And so this is going to continue. It's going to be on the back burner. But as we saw in northern Iraq, the Kurds are going to move very, very quickly to ensure that they have some sort of really tangible autonomous control in this area. And I would not be surprised if we're talking about a new Kurdish state or a new Kurdish entity coming into real existence in the next couple of months in northern Syria.
Now, Joseph, another story you've picked out for us, a pretty high-level Russian delegation paying a visit to the Egyptian capital today. This is an unusual visit, isn't it? Because we tend to think of Egypt as being very much the territory of the United States diplomatically and militarily.
Absolutely. And it goes back to this redefinition of kind of alliances and partnerships in the Middle East that's really taking over the region this week. Effectively, Russia is moving into Egypt with arms. It's ready to provide the Egyptians with up to $2 billion of new, fresh arms, including, you know, MiG airplanes and whatnot. And they've analyzed the situation and understood that there's an opening because the United States has suspended or at least curtailed some military aid to Egypt, which it's been giving to the country since really the late 70s in the Camp David peace accords. And so we see this new constellation that I think the Americans are not going to be too happy with, in which the Egyptians are getting money from Gulf countries. It's unsure which Gulf countries they're getting the specific money for the Russians is, and they're taking this money and spending it on Russian arms. And so this is really an incredible event. It's the first time that Russia has been able to kind of secure an arms deal with Egypt since the Cold War, and we might see a new kind of arms race happening because of this very delicate political situation that's unfolded in Egypt and the ramifications of that situation on the Egyptian Western or the Egyptian American alliance.
And finally, Joseph, you have a story for us about Turkish agribusiness and how it's potentially going to transform the Turkish economy.
Right. Quite briefly, Turkey's major energy production field that it has, at least inside of its own country, is food production. It's the most fertile land in the Middle East. And because food scarcity is a real big issue facing specifically Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, Turkey is looking to export a lot of this food to various countries in the Gulf area. Now, this food is, because Turkey is an Islamic country, the food is considered religiously halal, religiously acceptable from the time of production, and so it's a really natural fit for Turkey to start exporting this this energy product directly to the Gulf countries. Now, again, very briefly, one of the incidental kind of funny aspects of this story is that Turkey is looking for people to work on these farms, and because it has up to 600,000 Syrian refugees currently in the country, there are a lot of investment bankers that are looking for ways to allow these Syrians to actually be the farmhands and take over this very kind of lucrative job and help the country export even more food to the Gulf countries.
Thank you so much, Monocle's Eastern Mediterranean correspondent Joseph Dana. You're listening to Midori House.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll be heading to Paris Photo, and we'll also find out why our mayors should be the most important political figures in our lives.
The membranes between the ghettos on the one hand and the richer divisions on the other hand are quite porous. Poor people who go to cities see a much better chance to cross the border into a better life than they do in the rural regions.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with a wrap of the world headlines.
Thanks, Tom. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he's opposed to new sanctions against Iran, warning that they could scupper international talks on the country's nuclear program. A U.S. Senate committee is considering imposing new financial restrictions on Tehran. Relief workers in the Philippines say they're worried that disease could quickly spread among survivors of the country's powerful typhoon. While aid is now reaching some of the worst affected areas, access to clean water is still a priority for many of the 11 million people affected. 37 years after the former Brazilian president João Goulart was laid to rest, authorities have exhumed his remains. A new autopsy is to be carried out amid allegations that he may have been poisoned. Enrollment for President Obama's troubled healthcare system is much lower than expected. The administration says only 27,000 people have enrolled for health insurance via the federal website during its first month of operation. It had been estimated that nearly 500,000 people would join the scheme in the first month. Toronto's embattled mayor has rejected fresh calls to stand down. Rob Ford was at a city council meeting to hear colleagues say he should step aside while he gets help for his drinking and drug use. And the Pink Star, a huge flawless pink diamond, has sold for 76.3 million Swiss francs, including commission fees in Geneva. Sotheby's say it's a world record price for a gemstone at auction. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. It is 8:32 here in London. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of your world news headlines. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Tom Burgess-Watson. We turn now to this week's episode of The Urbanist. In it, we meet two men who believe that the most important figures in politics should be our mayors.
Both of these two men we're about to hear from have books hitting the shelves that say the same thing. Mayors are the most important political figures. Bruce Katz is vice president of the Brookings Institution and the co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution. And Benjamin Barber is a senior research scholar at the City University of New York and also an author of If Mayors Ruled the World. Well, both appeared together at an event hosted by the Centre for London, and Monocle producer David Michon caught up with them for today's edition of The Urbanist Show.
The reason for rapid urbanization is that people in developing countries are understanding that urbanization and the creativity, the entrepreneurship, the productivity, the class mobility out of poverty that it makes possible, even under conditions of considerable inequality that exist in the developed world, are such that cities make their own argument for why that's true. That is to say, you might say people are voting with their feet to go to cities because there's all sorts of possibilities of mobility, productivity, entrepreneurship, and creativity, even for the poor. You talked about the poor's membranes quite correctly between the city and the regions around them. The membranes between the ghettos on the one hand and the richer divisions on the other hand are quite porous as well. Poor people who go to cities see a much better chance to cross the border into a better life than they do in the rural regions. So those cities make their own arguments. Do they create problems on the way to doing it by their size, by their massiveness, by the sudden rapid growth? In China, you have 100 cities reaching a million within 10 years that hardly existed 10, 20 years ago. And those are radical changes, and lots of problems come with them. But the very urbanization that is the theme here of both of our work is itself a product of forces which speak for themselves. And I don't have to argue for urbanization. Urbanization makes its own argument.
Can you talk to me a bit about the link between the responsibility of cities or the value of cities in kind of creating an amazing place to live and as an economic driver as well?
I think actually you see the confluence of different disruptive dynamics. On the demographic side, we do see a greater portion of millennials choosing to live in denser areas, places that are walkable, livable, bikeable, more connected, frankly, where people have more choice where they live and how they move around. At the same time, what we see is a shift, and this may be as important as the demographic dynamic, a shift from closed innovation, science park innovation, where you have all these corporate campuses isolated far away from the central core, to open innovation, where firms are working in collaboration with each other, and networks of researchers and scientists and engineers are trying to crack the code on an energy issue or a health issue or some other issue. When you put those two things together, the demand for density by a new demographic and the demand for open innovation by companies and clusters of firms, what it basically supports is a return to the core, the downtowns and midtowns, where in the United States we have our anchor institutions, advanced research institutions, medical campuses, clusters of tech and creative firms, and urbanizing suburbs.
Is it kind of if you build it, they will come scenario? What does the city need to provide these days to attract that young urban professional?
Well, I would say in the United States, the innovation hubs are growing organically, but though with some sense of purpose around our anchor institutions and our downtowns and midtowns. There are a couple cities like Boston, like Seattle, like San Francisco, where rents and land values are so high. You can go into other parts of the city, older industrial parts of the city, the old naval facility, Hunter's Point in San Francisco, or the seaport in Boston, and begin to create these tech hubs. But for the most part, what's happening in the United States is ferocious growth. Small business, startups, residential, retail, amenities around places like Carnegie Mellon, Georgia Tech, obviously MIT, and other universities or medical campuses that are at the vanguard of innovation and idea generation, but also production, commercializing innovation, the prototyping of products, you know, for the domestic and global market. So I think it's a combination of building off your good bones that cities really do have in the United States, and these, you know, iconic institutions that now happen to be the platform for productive and innovative and resilient growth, and then in the hot, hot, hot markets, then having the ability, the fiscal ability, but also the political and, you know, civic leadership to begin to reclaim older industrial spaces.
I just wanted to ask you maybe about the role of the mayor. I mean, you see Michael Bloomberg as an example of someone who's taken a bit of a different approach and acts a bit more like a CEO than a political figure. So do you think that mayors of the future should be waning more towards a business approach to a city, running it like a corporation, than kind of a traditional political role?
I would say that was his worst defect. You don't have to be a businessman to have good ideas. And indeed, good ideas don't work unless you have the engagement and support of citizens. And one of the bad things about Bloomberg is that he had a lot of good ideas and failed to get real civic and political support for them, which meant they were easily shot down in the courts. They were easily thwarted and subverted by underlings who didn't want to do it and knew there was little support for it in the community. The idea of dealing with childhood obesity was brilliant, important, and a fundamental contribution to American public health. But he failed because he didn't get the teachers, he didn't get the parents, he didn't get the kids, he didn't get the Cuisinarian food establishment behind him in doing it. It was shot down by a court, but it wasn't working anyway because he basically got no support from it, from those who should have been supportive of it. So I would say running a public entity like a city, as if it were a private corporation, is to misunderstand the public and democratic character of the political institutions you're running.
That was Benjamin Barber and Bruce Katz, authors of If Mayors Ruled the World. I don't know if they want our Toronto mayor, Rob Ford, to be ruling the world.
I think he thinks he does rule the world.
Well, if he did, I think it'd be a good party.
Sometimes.
It would be pretty fun.
Depends what he's been
Not much work could get
to.
Done, though. Now, of course, you can hear the full interview on tonight's edition of the program, The Urbanist, which is at 1900 hours London time. That's 1400 hours on the East Coast of the United States and Canada.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back with a trip to Paris photo.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:40 here in London. We continue our show in the French capital, where the world's largest photo fair, Paris Photo, opens today. For the 17th edition of the event, the Grand Palais has attracted over 130 galleries from all around the world. But the man everyone is talking about is Harold Falkenberg, a private collector from Hamburg who owns some of the most famous and controversial pieces of contemporary art in the world.
Falkenberg's collection is featured there at Paris Photo this year, and that's a move that some people have perceived as a little bit of a statement on conceptual art. Well, we sent our very own Daphne Denis to the private viewing of that fair yesterday. She's on the line now from Paris to tell us more. Daphne, this is a pretty serious event, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a huge event. I don't know if you see the Grand Palais, which is an amazing, huge space, and there's 136 galleries exhibiting there, plus a private collector, plus Martin Parr's collection of protest photo books. So it's absolutely gigantic and beautiful and very much on the same level as La FIAC in Paris or Fries. In London and Hong Kong.
And Daphne, earlier this year we saw Paris Photo decamp and head over to Los Angeles. They held their first American fair at Paramount Studios, drawing in quite a few fair number of visitors. Is this a growing sign of the importance of Paris Photo on the international stage?
Absolutely, yes. I think going to LA was an incredibly good move for Paris Photo because we have more and more international galleries that are coming to show up. We have, for example, a Mexican gallery that's there, a Russian gallery also this year. I think it's really, really helped enhance their importance on the international stage, although it's already the world's largest photo fair.
And Daphne, I'm assuming all these exciting exhibitions and so on has meant a fair share of vernissage and cocktail parties and everything else. Tell us a little bit about who you've been rubbing shoulders with there at Paris Photo.
Well, I've met quite a few people. I'm meeting the director of the fair today. But yesterday I met a very important man that you were mentioning just now, Harold Falkenberg, who's an incredible collector, 70 years old, and he just loves messy art. He loves art that makes people uneasy. He actually says that he doesn't really believe in culture, and I can make you listen to what he told me yesterday about what he thinks of culture.
See, the line is that the artists collect don't understand art as a part of the culture, but art as pointed against culture. They understand art as a counterculture. So you see, if art becomes old and is accepted everywhere, then it is culture. They want to work at a stage where art is not yet culturized.
So you can hear that kind of his take. One of the pieces that he's exhibiting is a photo by an artist called Phil Collins, not to be confused with the singer, by the way, of Britney Spears scribbled all over with sort of a fake moustache. So it's not pretty art, but it's stuff that obviously makes you wonder and think about the concept of art. So it was really interesting to obviously have a chat with him about, you know, what he considers, how he chooses photography.
We were wondering who that picture was.
I couldn't recognize that as Britney Spears.
It doesn't look like Britney Spears, no.
But with all the scribbling, I'm not really surprised that we couldn't tell who that was.
Now, Daphne, there's some other interesting pieces within the Falkenberg collection. There's an interesting installation at the moment by a man named Jonathan Messe as well. So a really eclectic mix of pieces, aren't there?
Absolutely. I mean, he has made some exceptions. He's got some photographs by Walker Evans, for instance, who's obviously one of the most iconic photographers in America, and Lee Friedlander, for instance. But he's got, despite the fact that he's obviously a very wealthy man and a very an art collector, he's got a very controversial and sort of anti-collector stance on art, and I think we can listen to him speak about collectors again and what he thinks of them.
We see before us a group monopolizing the art for themselves, but they only need it to make themselves more valuable. They don't care for art at all. As a collector, I can say for myself, yeah, it's not so bad. Also, my works have double or triple or quadruple of the price as before, so let them do. But I can't buy these works anymore, or I'm not willing to buy them at that price. So I think maybe this exhibition or this invitation is a little like a screw putting some steam out of the engine, yes?
So it's obviously really interesting to hear Falkenberg talk about this stance on art and collecting in a fair that's obviously for art collectors. I mean, it's a fair where obviously the photographs are shown to be sold. So it's interesting to look at the way that Paris Photo is going in that direction with a man that's so radical in his thinking about photography.
Daphne, what are your sort of personal favourite moments so far? And what are you perhaps looking forward to most there at Paris Photo before you come back to us in London?
I am very much looking forward to talk about, obviously, the Photo Book of Awards at Aperture, which is one of the biggest events of Paris Photo. I'm also just looking forward to meeting more gallery owners and talking to more people. I've been they've got a really interesting concept of showing three new galleries and talk about their recent acquisitions and the way that they collect, the way that they're sort of thinking about photography. And I spoke yesterday with two Brazilian gallery owners who are focused on urbanism in Brazil, and it was just fascinating to see how they commission work as well as just collect photography that's already been done. So it's just really interesting to see new ways to think about photography as a medium.
Daphne, I think I know the real reason why you want to be there is because you want the cocktail parties. Let's be honest. Come on.
The cocktail parties are quite good. There was a lot of champagne yesterday around. It was wonderful. Yeah.
Enjoy your stay in Paris and at Paris Photo. Monocle's Daphne Denny, many thanks for joining us.
Before we have our final element of the day, the newspaper review, let's have a tune. Here's Avec Sans with, they're from London, by the way, with their track Shiver. That was Avec Sans with their track Shiver.
Brr. Well, you're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn.
I think I might shiver. Yeah, it's chilly, isn't it, here in London?
Well, things are going to get a little warmer in the studio now because we're delighted to say that we're joined by our very favourite Welshman, Tom Lewis. I understand it's a bit of a special day. Shall we say it, Tom? We've been practicing.
Ben Blid Hapus.
Diolch yn fawr iawn. Thank you very much
indeed.
Happy
birthday.
How special.
Happy birthday.
As I say goodbye to one decade and dip my toes into the next.
Big 4-0, huh?
Pleasure to be the big 4-0. Yes. Just a little bit behind you, Phil.
Just for the
no. But thank you very much indeed. Example. Appreciate it. What a lovely way to start a birthday.
Yeah, we've got Pembroke Happers. Yeah. So what have you got for us on this birthday edition?
Well, I don't want to poop the party or anything, obviously, before it's even begun. But I thought we'd start with a front page story on The Independent today. This is about the Chilcot inquiry here in the UK into why the UK participated in the Iraq War in 2003. Now, this inquiry has been going for about 4 years now, started in 2009, and it's been delayed and there have been setbacks that have put back its publication pretty significantly. Now, The Independent leads with this story, which it labels an exclusive, saying that actually the reason, one of the key reasons that this report has been delayed so much is because of the State Department in the US not releasing key documents relating to the correspondence between then Prime Minister Tony Blair and then President George W. Bush. Now, that might not come as a huge surprise that they wouldn't release a lot of sensitive information, seeing as it isn't actually that long ago, and often classified documents remain classified for really quite a long time. But the Independent spin on it is that actually this is really hindering maybe a British attempt to try and come to the truth of why we were there, and also to try and move on for the service personnel and their families who obviously still feel the effects of that war, and also for Britain to come to terms with its role in one of the most contentious foreign policy decisions in recent memory.
And also very potentially politically embarrassing for David Cameron, isn't it? Because he would have to potentially block some of this evidence because of Washington.
That's right, exactly. And a phrase that's often used here about the relationship between the USA and the United Kingdom is a special relationship. Now, how special that becomes if David Cameron then has to block his own country's information, if you like, or his own country's process because of the demands of the USA, will be pretty difficult, I'd say, for Prime Minister Cameron to sell to the British public and to his own MPs.
Now, another story you've spotted for us, and we should go back to our previous discussion, which of course it's your birthday, but it isn't just your birthday, is it, Thomas Lewis?
No, there's another maybe less important birthday happening today as well.
And I think a lot of people would agree with that.
There are a lot of the British front pages have photos of Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales.
It is his birthday today. Happy birthday to him in Welsh as well.
Yes, you could indeed. He is in fact a Welsh speaker of sorts now and again. But yes, he is 65 today, and a lot of the papers make quite a big fact that he is...
Is that all?
Well, he's a pensioner officially today in the UK when you're 65.
Discounts,
exactly. You can ride on the bus for cheaper. You can cut queues and things. No, I think you do have to pay a little
I'm
tiny
sum. I'm not there yet. I'm not sure. I thought it was
I was going to say, you might know better than me,
years.
Tom. But
yes, I would know better. It's going to affect me sooner. But anyway.
But Prince Charles's wife, Camilla, the Duchess... the Duchess of Cornwall, excuse me. I almost forgot that. I was going to say the Duchess of Cambridge, but that's someone else.
That's another one.
Has given interviews to some of the big newspapers. The Daily Telegraph has an interview with her. They are currently on a trip of India, obviously, at the moment. Now, Camilla describes her husband as hopeless, annoying, and exhausting. That's the headline in the Daily Telegraph.
That's saying, like, loving endorsement.
Did you write that, Phil? How about you?
She says that he's a workaholic and that he really, even on his birthday, that he really probably won't sit down and put his feet up. Even though he does enjoy celebrating his birthday, apparently, with a party with a cake. A party is not complete without a cake, according to Prince Charles, and a good rousing rendition of Happy Birthday. That's apparently how the future King of the United Kingdom will be spending his special day today. And don't forget,
and I hope some special cake has been produced for him.
Well, some students, there's a photo in the Times, some students have kindly, lovingly baked him a Black Forest gâteau. There you can see there, Tom, with some glacé cherries around the fringe and a big 65 in the middle. Now, the Guardian's take on this is quite interesting. It's an article by a very close friend of his, a very prominent broadcaster here in the UK, Jonathan Dimbleby, and he basically says, he looks at the fact that Prince Charles is the longest serving heir to the throne in British history and will likely be the oldest monarch to come to the throne when that time comes, and that actually that's put Prince Charles in a very odd position, if you like, and the way he's carved that role out for himself is obviously something that people across the UK debate on a regular basis, and of course that profile in Time magazine very recently sort of began that debate again, people looking again at Prince
Charles. He is slowly taking on more duties, like he is representing the Queen for the very first time at this Heads of Commonwealth
Commonwealth meeting in India, in Sri Lanka, which of course is a big move as well.
He is, absolutely, and both he and Prince William too, and Prince Harry as well, have been taking on a lot more duties, kind of showing a shift to the royal family maybe. But I think the reason maybe Prince Charles is somewhat of a contentious figure sometimes here in the UK is that obviously he's been very outspoken on a wide variety of topics, from architecture to the environment. Feels that a lot of experts in those fields say, well, he doesn't really have that much expertise at all in those. But obviously, again, he is a voice, a very prominent voice here in the UK, and those are his views, and he has decided to share them over a long period of time. And that's not really something we're very used to with the royal family. So that's maybe been somewhat of an inspiration maybe to people like Prince William and Prince Harry, who are showing possibly a more open face to the royal family as time moves ahead.
Yeah, well, he does have some fairly authoritative views, though, on gardening and compost and the like.
So, he does indeed,
that's,
Tom.
That's an area where, yes, I think he could add greatly.
You should bring your roses in one day, Tom, and show us the inspiration he's been to you. But happy birthday to Prince Charles.
And happy birthday to yourself. To you too.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it very
thank
much.
Thank you
indeed.
To our very dear Welsh producer, Thomas Lewis, with today's British newspapers.
That's unfortunately all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maddie Arouge, and our studio manager was Bill Luthi. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, 7 a.m. in New York. I'll be back with Georgina Godwin for the same time tomorrow for Midori House. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Tom Burgess-Watson, thank you very much for listening.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.